Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Peeling Back Money and Life. I'm Casey, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike. And how's it going today?
Hey, Casey, I am doing fantastic. Excited to dive into today's topic about becoming the wise investor. We've got a lot to cover today, so let's jump right in.
And we're going to start with knowing your history. Understanding, you know, past market trends, the crashes, the recoveries is crucial for us as individual investors. You know, it doesn't mean that we're predicting the future, but knowing what has happened in the past provides valuable insights and will help us when the markets will inevitably go down. We don't know when or by how much, but we do know they will go down, and you know, based upon past history, they will eventually recover as well. Just may take, you know, years for them to recover, or sometimes just weeks or months. It just all depends. But when somebody truly gets this, their emotions will play less of a role. Instead, you know, look at like, oh, markets went up today, or awesome, the markets went down today. You know, look at them that like they're on sale, like, you know, you're going to the mall and or you're going grocery shopping and yeah, it's on sale, I'm going to buy that. That when you truly get that deep down, that's when you kind of know that you made that shift. And for some people, it means going through a bear market or going through one of those downturns to be able to truly let that sink in for them. But it's something that we continually remind ourselves of. And if you haven't gone through a bear market, you know, do some reading on it, whether it's, you know, listening to some podcasts or reading a book. The Four Pillars of Investing is a great book on that. With that, it's crucial to reflect, you know, on your personal reactions too. How do you react if you haven't experienced one when you're reading that book? That's kind of a tough one. But as you go through the market peaks and the valleys, you know, whether it's going up 20, 30, 40% or going the other way, how have you stayed the course in the past? Or have you made changes? Or maybe like in 2001, maybe you made a change, but then 08, 09, you educate yourself more, you're more emotionally sound, and you didn't make a change. What emotions, you know, did you experience? By reflecting on those and by learning from our history and our own experiences, we can make more informed decisions, remaining focused on the long term and having a better understanding of what we own and why, which will inevitably, you know, help us in the long run with our financials.
Yeah, it's absolutely vital that we look at the history and reflect on our personal experiences as the rise in the stock market is hardly ever smooth. You know, it's much like a roller coaster, and you know, they have a slow ascent up, and maybe, you know, you get to the top of that peak and it's brief, and then there's a rapid fall, just like a roller coaster. You know, when the stock market's rising, it seems it'll go up day after day after day. You know, and we're hearing every day making all-time highs, you know, after all-time high, you know. And it's helpful to look at history and understand how the stock market recovers from corrections and bear markets. The stock market is the only market where goods go on sale and everyone is too afraid to buy. You know, Casey mentioned just a moment ago that it goes down, it's like being on sale. You know, as Warren Buffett famously said, be fearful when others are greedy and be greedy when others are fearful. So what he's getting at is don't be afraid of those downturns. You know, history has shown us long-term that the market goes up and we need to not be afraid. You know, we can buy more of that stock when it happens to go down. So time is your friend and emotions are your enemy when it comes to the market. You know, our good friend Mike Findley likes to say, be the robot when it comes to investing. And that just take your emotions and put them to the side and base your decisions on, you know, the history that you've studied. And I want to give you a little bit of history here to give you an example. You know, the S&P 500, it's risen 1,100-fold in the 70-year time period that it's been around. You know, this includes dividends, but look what happened during this period. You know, and I want to give you some rises and some falls here. From May of 46 to May of 47, a 1 year time span. You know, that's 80 years ago, but stocks plunged a little over 28%. You know, that's 46 to 47 years. From June of 48 to June of 49, stocks declined 20.6%. From June of 50 to July of 50, they fell 14%. You know, from 1957 in July to October of 57, they fell again by almost 21%. Again, 62 from January to June, 26%. February is 66 to October is 66, 22%. You know, it goes on and on. Where these stocks have fallen over and over by 20, 30, 40, 50%, right? But yet, go back to the fact that, you know, what I mentioned at the start, the S&P 500 rose 1,100-fold in that 70, you know, year time frame. So even though we have these big falls like I just talked about, stocks gained immensely over this time, you know, this time period. So, you know, what's the key there? Time is your friend. You know, investing is a long-term activity. If you're doing investing in the short term, that's called speculation. It's not called investing. And so now, Casey, our next point is about time. And in time being that powerful tool investing, it's often underestimated. And so the longer you stay invested, the more you let compounding work. And that is absolutely magic. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, let that compound magic work. And in letting the rule of 72 is, you know, is that rule of compounding performance magic. And patience is key for any investor here when looking to build that long-term wealth. You know, it's about time in the market, not timing the market. And you're going to hear that over and over again in this episode intentionally, because it's so vital to your long-term financial future. The market will pay for you to be patient. You know, it can often be boring, you know, versus watching CNBC and, you know, what's the next hot stock or what's Bitcoin doing? You know, if you're the person who is just solely invested in index, you know, mutual funds, index ETFs, but in getting the market return. But, you know, John Bogle would say, just stay the course. You know, that short-term pain of a bear market, you know, when things go on sale again, it's time for you to buy. You know, it will charge you for taking too much action. So if you're just trying to time the market from buying and selling, we know that time in the market is what really matters. And research has proven that over and over and over again. But emotions, you know, whether it's going up or down, often tend to take over. You're going to pay dearly for those impulse emotional decisions. And now more than ever, that it can be just a click of a button versus, you know, back in the day, a call on your broker. So there's numerous challenges to an investor, you know, having the discipline and staying the course, you know, whether it's the mutual fund industry, whether it's CNBC with the financial press or the brokerage industry, they can throw all different kinds of things at us. And maybe it's misrepresenting thing or predicting this next hot stock or the next hot fund that's going to outperform, you know, everything else in its path, or, you know, when's the next bear market, the next bull market going to be. But the reality is that little evidence supports the notion that investors can successfully time the markets. You may have heard it maybe once, but for somebody to do it over and over again, it's less and less likely. You know, so listening to too much media, friends and family, even coworkers in the break room or neighbors, although their intentions might be good, they don't know what your plans and your goals are. And often they may tell you about the times they have won, but not necessarily the times they have lost. And just to kind of give an example of, you know, time in the market versus timing the market. You know, for example, an investor just with $1,000 in the S&P 500 in October of 1989 would have $11,510 in December of 2016. That's just 1,000 growing all the way to 11,500. If that investor had tried to beat the market and missed just the best 15 days over that 27-year time period, he would have just under 4,500. Missing the best 25 days produces a final total of about 2,900. So that just proves the point of it's time in the market versus timing the market. But yet investors, we tend to have a bad habit of trying to buy the winners too late or dumping the losers too soon, because you have to get it right twice. You have to know when to get out and you have to know when to get back in to really do it. So trying to do that both ways, it's very, very tough, and the odds are just not in your favor. It's trying to, basically you're in the loser's game. That book was by
Charlie Ellis.
Charlie Ellis. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, you're right, Casey. And we want to make sure, you know, we check our ego at the door and remain humble. And we'll talk further on these topics come up in a few podcasts, but staying the course does not necessarily mean sitting still. It means avoiding bad behavior, remembering your goals, and ensuring that your approach And what you do in the markets, it's focused around discipline and doing what you know. On the other hand, you know, some people don't pull all their money out of the market, but change their asset allocation to chase the asset class that's been performing well recently. You know, frequently changing your asset allocation typically is less damaging to your investments than exiting the market as a whole, but that transaction costs, you know, there's tax consequences, and buying and selling also erodes your returns. So take your plan and then follow these words by the late Jack Bogle. Stay the course. No matter what happens, stick to your program. I've said stay the course 1,000 times, and I meant it every time. It is the most important single piece of investment wisdom I can give to you. And again, that's by John Bogle.
Yeah, and that leads right into our next topic. Simplicity beats complexity. Simplicity beats complexity. And nothing is simpler than staying the course. It's not easy, you know, just like, you know, eating right, you know, not indulging in other things. It's not easy, but it can be maybe simple. So simple strategies often outperform complicated ones. Yes, they may be boring. They're not going to be as sexy as stuff on CNBC, and that's why we don't hear them on the news or see them much on the internet. But if it works, then that's all that really should matter. You know, one of the greatest investors of our time, Warren Buffett, follows a simple principle: invest in something you understand. If it's something that you don't understand, you know, then encourage you to get out. We often come across people, you know, with investment accounts, whether it's, you know, previous 401ks with other employers, or maybe it's IRA accounts that they have at multiple different places. You know, it goes back to that simplicity factor. Are you complicating your life more by leaving things, you know, just kind of out there? And same thing with funds. You know, we see people with dozens and dozens and sometimes hundreds of funds, when we talked about in a previous episode, that you can get it just in 10 or less. You can own the whole world in even just one fund. You know, whether it's individuals having life insurance or annuity products that they don't fully understand, or even remember why they have them. You know, sometimes it was right at the time, but as their life changed, it didn't suit them anymore, but they didn't change it because maybe they forgot about it or they didn't know what to do with it. So encourage you to keep reviewing. What do you have? Do you need it? Do you know why you have it? You know, what is it costing you? And if you aren't able to answer some of those questions, it might be worth your time, worth your money to seek out a professional that can, you know, provide their valuable advice and weight in gold, essentially, by simplifying your approach. They can simplify your life.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm all about simplicity, Casey. Complicated strategies, that, you know, they sound sophisticated, but simplicity often leads to, as you said, a better understanding and execution. It's about sticking to the basics and avoid all that unnecessary complexity that you really don't need in your portfolio. You know, don't worry about having a large number of funds. You know, I have most of the time less than 10 funds in my portfolio. And in order to achieve good returns, you don't need to be any more complex than that. You know, owning anywhere from 1 to 10 funds is perfect for most people. You can achieve a very well diversified portfolio with just one fund. You know, the total stock market index fund, you know, from Vanguard owns over 3,500 companies. That's extremely diversified. Or choosing a target date fund or a life cycle fund or a balanced fund, that includes thousands of companies, and it would suit you just well. You know, for example, such a fund might include international and U.S. stocks and bonds all in one fund. So just remember, complexity doesn't necessarily mean better results in the world of investing. You know, if you don't understand, again, Casey said this, if you don't understand why you own it, it might be a sign that you shouldn't own it. Or you could benefit from the assistance of maybe a fee-only financial planner. Annuities, for instance, can be quite complex and quite expensive if you don't know why you would need them or why you have them. So, you know, our advice typically to the young person is you start small with one or two funds, and then over time, as you add to your portfolio, add different funds, but know why you're adding them and what the benefit to your portfolio would be by having them there. And then that'll increase your diversification. And ultimately what we want to do by reducing that increasing that diversification is to reduce the overall volatility in our funds. So, you know, another topic, and we talk about occasionally, is consider maybe overweighting some certain sectors. As you're building your portfolio, maybe you want it to look like the entire U.S. economy. However, you know, there's some research out there by different individuals that show maybe certain classes have performed better than the market over time. And so, you know, two that we like to talk about is Fama and French, Eugene Fama and Ken French. And they were at the University of Chicago, and they did a bunch of study on factor-based investing. And what they found is, if you overweight, meaning that you own more of a specific market segment than the actual market makes up, and they like to talk about small cap and value companies. And so the total stock market maybe doesn't offer, it offers the same ratio of what that sector makes up in the economy, but maybe overweighting it would be owning a special fund that just has those small cap or value companies in it. So, you know, if it's only got a small percentage of small cap value, you're going to choose to have that additional amount to overweight your portfolio. And that's, you don't have to do that. It's just kind of optional if you want to make your portfolio slightly more complex with only adding one fund. But really, you know, again, if this overwhelms you, just stick to simple. You don't have to do this. And, you know, remember, again, time is your friend, and let that power of compounding and the rule of 72, let those things play out. You know, those things are strong. And once you understand that, you know, and, you know, even better, once you witness it in action, it can truly be amazing. You know, I love oftentimes we hear, and I don't know if he actually said it or not, but he's credited with it, that, you know, Albert Einstein said that compound interest is the most powerful powerful force in the universe. I just love that. So, Casey?
Absolutely. And, you know, a kind of great segue with mentioning Eugene Fama and Kenneth French, of learning from those independent experts, learning from those ones who have done the research, who have been in the trenches, who don't have those conflicts of interest, you know, again, whether that's through books or podcasts or blogs. And we've named a few of them here, but I want to reiterate them again. You know, it could be Charles Ellis, Burt Mankiel, Rick Ferry, Jane Bryant Quinn. William Bernstein just came out with a second edition of The Four Pillars of Investing, a great book. John Bogle and Daniel Sloan. You know, having that knowledge, you know, going back to what we talked about at the beginning of the episode with knowing your history, is going to help reduce that fear and increase your confidence. No, it's not going to go away. Just like, you know, pain and struggle and suffering and challenges in life are inevitably going to happen no matter what. That's just part of life. But we can help mitigate those as much as possible by continuing to gather that knowledge from the right sources. You know, the more and more you understand the bubbles, the more and more you understand what herd behavior is and some of those financial terminologies out there. You know, it's kind of like learning the investing language. Just like if you're trying to learn a foreign language, it can be like that at the beginning, but then over time it gets a little bit easier. So don't wait until you have it all figured out, because you never will. You know, there's been people have been studying this for decades and they don't have it all figured out either. So whether that's, you know, doing a bunch of research on your own from those independent experts and or seeking advice, in the financial industry from somebody who is fee only, who that limits the conflicts of advice versus somebody who's commission based.
Yeah, I always look for those unbiased opinions, Casey, those independent experts that you talked about, you know, the ones that have been in the trenches, as you said, that read the research and done or are doing the research. They offer very valuable insights to me, you know, without being swayed by any external pressures. And by the external pressures, I mean, you know, what is some company trying to sell me, or how do they benefit from whatever, you know, they're recommending. So it's a crucial aspect of making really well-informed financial decisions for yourself and learning from those, you know, that were ahead of us, like Casey said, and who have the most experience and dedicated their time to understanding all this. So to help our listeners implement this in their own lives, you know, one effective strategy is to add, you know, add to your schedule. You know, choose one book to read a year and allocate time for it in your calendar. Put it on your calendar. You know, after reading that book, take some time to think about it, to reflect on it, to journal about it, review its contents, maybe read it a second time and consider how you can apply the things or the principles in that book to your own situation as it applies to your investments. A simple habit can yield significant rewards as you accumulate and build upon your knowledge year after year. By intentionally just blocking that time off in your schedule, you're gonna create a dedicated space. It's gonna become a habit. And we've talked about learning and self-improvement is important in the past. This will help to build that. It will help to build your knowledge on these things. And whether you have a financial planner that you use or they may manage your investments independently or continuously learning, is crucial for staying informed, to what you're going to do or what they're doing, to help you to make those informed decisions day after day. Remember, investing is a journey. I mentioned a little while ago, it's not short-term. Short-term investing is called speculation, and it's akin to gambling. And so every piece of knowledge that you pick up on this journey will contribute to your long-term success. If you have a professional guiding you, don't be afraid to ask them what they're doing, or maybe ask them for recommendations on what to do as you learn these things. So the more you learn from, the independent experts, and what we mean by that is if somebody works or somebody's recommending you a product that their company sells, they're probably getting a commission on that. And so, that's not really what we would consider an independent expert. And then two, the more you learn from these independent experts, as I talked about, the greater you're going to understand the investment language. And it's confusing. We've thrown out some different terms, and it's hard to understand. But the more you read, the more you're going to understand these terms. For example, we talked about the rule of 72, how long it takes for you to double your money based on time and interest rate. Another term, loss aversion, recency bias, reversion to the mean, modern portfolio theory, and it goes on and on. It's like learning a foreign language, but like learning anything else, the more you expose yourself and review and reflect and apply, those terms to your situation, the better off you're going to be. And this doesn't apply solely in the world of money. This is everywhere. And so how do you learn that language, right? Take one at a time. As you're reading a book, if I'm reading any book, I keep a dictionary, which is on my phone, but I keep the dictionary open all the time. If I come across a word I don't know, I look it up and I write in the margin what that word means. I review, I ask questions about those terms. A lot of times something will come up and I'm like, hey, Casey, what does this mean to you? Right. And so, again, take notes and talk about this with someone else. And then the ultimate way of learning is, like Casey mentioned earlier, is teach it to somebody. That's when you can teach it to somebody in a simple way, you've really learned it and mastered it.
Absolutely, Mike. So the next time, whether you're, talking to family or friends or coworkers, encourage you to try teach a concept to them. Maybe it's something that they said, or maybe it's something that you're reading about and you've read it, you've reflected on it, you wrote about it a little bit, but now you want to explain it out loud. And it's totally normal to stumble a few times. That's part of the learning process. We knew this as kids, or if we have kids that we see them doing it and we're okay with it, but we often forget that it's an okay thing to do that as adults. That, as we're learning something, we're going to stumble and we're going to be like, oh, what was that again? And that's just part of cementing it in. And that's, if you read some of the research on how to learn, they echo that. So even if a colleague or somebody's coming up to you and you're having your normal, coffee shop talk, have them explain what they're talking about. This will give you an idea. Do they know what they're talking about? And it's not about shaming them. It's seeing if they are a credible source. And it's also trying to learn from them and understand, where they're getting their information as well. Is it coming from the same lens, same perspective that whether you're hearing it on here or somewhere else, versus, hearing it on the media, for example. And You know, turn off the media and see what it does to your stress and anxiety levels. The less and less TV I watch, the better sleep I get, the more relaxed I am, my stress levels way down. I just encourage you to try it out. Turning off that noise, and whether it's your phone or your computer, just every once in a while, just sitting in some quiet, that will give you time to absorb that information that you just read and to be able to teach it with somebody else a lot better.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and talking about the media kind of gets me going. The media tends to sensationalize, every single market move. You know, why do they sensationalize it? Well, they create the excitement or they create the fear, because when they do that, you're going to tune in day after day after day, and you're just going to get sucked into this. And it's really about greed, right? I mean, they want you to continue to tune in because it's more advertising dollars for them. So when you're hearing this stuff on TV, understand, it's where it's coming from and what, the psychology behind what they're telling you, and again, just turn all that off. I rarely watch the news anymore. And if I do, I understand that bias, that they have to sensationalize it. So, I'm the same boat Casey did. When I tuned that out, my stress level went way down and I sleep better and I'm just a happier person. And another crucial aspect is you just be skeptical of what people are telling you. Not everything you hear or read, is accurate for one or even relevant to your investment strategy. So, it's important to question that information and do your own research. And then once you've done, once you hear something, fact check it, find out if that new information comes in at other sources. Are you hearing the same thing elsewhere? Information you hear on this podcast, we encourage you to fact check it like you should with anything else that you're going to read. And you should do that with every source of information that you're absorbing. Just blindly following anybody's advice can lead you to bad decisions. Always question, always verify. And, that'll help you to just make long-term, better informed decisions.
And that leads us into our next topic of understanding risk and reward. And the more you educate yourself, the more you'll understand this, that there's risk in everything that we do, whether it's market, it's political, environment, it's liquidity, inflation risk is a huge one. And many of those risks we don't have control over at all, right? But risk often equals return. You may have heard the term risk tolerance before, and that's more your personal willingness to withstand volatility and losses. It's more in line with your emotions and your psychology than it really is your financial means. So just because you have the financial ability, you still may be risk averse, which affects your risk tolerance. You may be that way your whole life, even as your assets go up. Are you able to sleep at night with the level of risk you're taking? And this is hard to really nail down and determine until you've experienced a market downturn. Reading books and listening to other people can only go so far. You need to go one through yourself and see what emotions you have and see what reactions that you have to what the market's doing, what your investments are personally doing. That way that you can increase your likelihood of being able to be more comfortable with risk. A book by Morgan Housel, The Psychology of Money, in there he talks about, our findings suggest that individual investors' willingness to bear risk depends on personal history. That just speaks to that point of, you haven't gone through a bear market, it's tough. So, what happened in your life growing up? You think of people in the 70s or people from World War II, they grew up way different than people are growing up now. And that is going to affect how they invest. It's not that, oh, he's smarter than me, or she's smarter than me, or they had it much better than me, or they don't know what they're talking about. It's, we have our own, perspectives and lenses based upon our experiences. Were we unemployed for a certain amount of time? How do you approach this any differently, Mike?
No, risk and reward, they go hand in hand. And it's for each individual, it's about finding that right balance that aligns with your financial goals and your risk tolerance, which you may not even know what your risk tolerance is if you're just starting out in this. And so, again, diversification plays a key role, as do so many things, right? your risk tolerance will change as your life goes on. You know, when you're young, you know, we have a lot more time, you know, and if you understand that over time the markets go up, you can be more risky, you know. As you've accumulated a nice amount, you're getting closer to where you want to start withdrawing that money and you need that money for 20 years in retirement, maybe your risk tolerance changes a little bit. And so, and that's okay. I mean, that's understanding and knowing and being knowledgeable and applying that, you know, information to your life. You know, some good times to consider reevaluating your risk, you know, it's when maybe getting married or maybe when you have kids or, you know, maybe you're changing jobs at a mid-career level or relocating. You know, maybe you received an inheritance from somebody in your family that passed on. Or maybe you're getting close to retirement. Those are all great places to really take a look at what your risk tolerance is and how much you should be taking. And in saying that too, just because you're willing to take risk doesn't mean that you have to take risk. And we're going to talk about that in an upcoming episode where we talk about having enough, right? You know, maybe you don't need to take as much risk as you're willing to take, and that's okay too. So some ways to maybe increase your risk tolerance if you need to take more risk is look at what you have in short-term savings. You know, how much do you have in the bank to withstand a downturn? Understanding the history of the markets and the theory. You know, at the beginning of this podcast, I went through all those different time periods where the market fell 20, 30, 40%. And over the span of that 70 years, it went up 1,100 times. So just really, really understanding that history is important to help him with your risk tolerance. Maybe having multiple streams of income, you know, if you and a spouse both have incomes, or maybe you have a side hustle too, that helps to increase your risk tolerance if you need it. And so really just a thorough understanding of all these different risks, and there's so many. There's inflation, there's monetary policy, there's political, there's on and on and on, just different kinds of risks to understand. And the more you understand those, the more likely it is that you'll be able to increase your risk tolerance if you need to. And then, you know, having a shift in attitude or perspective, and that's going to come through knowledge, that'll help you as well. So,
and you know, with all that, sometimes we can be our own worst enemy. You know, I think of, you know, going back to harnessing our emotions. And I think of Dan Siegel, who came up with the phrase, name it to tame it. It's simple, it's science backed. So, you know, for an example here, let's say the markets have taken a downturn and it's causing you some anxiety, some fear, you're losing some sleep. You know, a way to do it is name it to tame it strategy. You know, you first acknowledge and label the emotions you're experiencing. So you might say, you know, I'm feeling fearful about the market downturn, and you're naming the emotion there. You're bringing awareness to it, and you're taking a step back from just being consumed by it. So instead of reacting to it. And once you've named it, you can take a moment to reflect on it and why you're feeling that way. You know, so whether it's, you know, just internalizing in your head or writing it down or talking out loud, it may feel weird at first, but trust me, it's going to help you the next time it comes up, because we're humans. We're going to have emotions. Yeah, we talked about being that robot before, but the reality of it is we're going to have those emotions, and it's okay. We wouldn't be human otherwise. So the more and more you can label it and acknowledge and understand those, the longer term investment decisions that you're going to make, that's going to reward you in the long term.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to keep those emotions in check. You know, I'm guilty of this. You know, I'm basically what I guess we'd call a recovering news junkie, right? I used to get sucked in, and I'd get sucked into all of that, and it's an emotional nightmare. And just through learning and experiencing and reflecting, you know, that's how I had to approach it to get my emotions, you know, under check. Like you said, they're your worst enemy, you know, when you're investing. I talk to people all the time. You know, you watch Fox News or CNN or whatever your news channel is you watch, and it's fear. You know, oh, the market's going to crash. The market's going to crash. Okay, so what if it does? You know, look at that long-term history. You know, you got to understand this and you know, be disciplined and rational about it. And otherwise, your emotions are going to get the best of you. And there's people who got out of the market in 2008 and 2009 that have never gotten back in the market. And you know, it's gone up so much since then. So there's just, it is a big part of it. And you have to take that time to reflect, you know. And our ego can blindside us as well to our own limitations. And they can lead us to make, you know, dumb decisions based on those emotions. You know, do I get out of the market when it goes down? No. You know, but that's not what our psyche is telling us, you know, rather than thinking about it in a rational way. So stay humble, you know, recognize that this world of investing is a journey, and it's all about learning, and it's all about growth. And it's important to be, you know, just to be willing and admit that we don't know something. That's okay. You know, this humility is going to allow you to make more informed and more objective decisions. And ultimately, it's going to lead to better long-term outcomes. So remember, investing is not about proving ourselves right or outperforming others. You know, it's not about that. It's about using it and achieving that investment to, you know, further our financial goals and maintaining that disciplined approach. You know, just by staying humble and keeping your ego, you know, at the door, you can stay focused on that big picture and make those right decisions that, you know, align with those objectives that we've thought about that are long-term. And so by using the, you know, what Casey talked about, the name it to tame it strategy, you're you know, basically giving yourself that space to process those emotions without getting overwhelmed by them. You know, it's about recognizing market fluctuations are going to happen. They're a part of normal life. And, it, you know, in investing, in the emotions to the greatest degree possible should not dictate your decision-making process. You know, so I guess know what you own and why you own it would be the next thing that we want to talk about, Casey.
Absolutely. We mentioned this before, and you know, some tips for our listeners to help them understand, you know, why they own what they own and what they own. You know, if you haven't, again, you know, do that research, do the due diligence, but write down what you have. Even if you have a financial professional, you're doing it yourself, you know, look at all the investments that you have. With your statements, if you have a spreadsheet or a summary, if you have an investment policy statement, also called an IPS, that's, you know, outlines your investment goals and your risk tolerance and your strategy. You know, that can be huge in helping to understand, doing that portfolio review if you're doing it by yourself or sitting down with a professional to help understand. And if they're not willing to sit down and help you understand, then maybe you need to look elsewhere. And there's plenty of tools and resources out there. But if you're unsure of what you own, even if you have a professional, I highly, highly encourage you at your next meeting to ask some more questions to help understand. And it's not going to come in one meeting. And, you know, it's going to take time, but you're taking that step forward. You're taking that leap. You're acting courageous, and it's going to prove benefits for you in the future. And next, you know, with understanding what you own, it's about understanding your fees, right, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. But you know, I want to just drop back to, you know, and it is, it's a good thing to ask your investment professional, if you use one, you know, why you're in certain fees. And this is sad, but honestly, when we talk to our customers that have asked their professionals that in years past, you know, we get answers like, oh, that's what our corporate investment team thinks you need to be. And well, that's not really an answer. And if that's the answer you're getting, you're probably at the wrong, you know, investment company, which is, you know, in that case, you know, seek out a fee-only investment advisor, or better yet, learn all these things that we're talking about and do it on your own. So, jumping over to fees, you know, let's not forget about that. You know, every investment you have, it's going to have a cost, you know, and you may or may not realize that you're even paying that cost, you know. In the case, you know, if you're with a investment advisor and, you know, you ask them what you're paying them, oh, you don't pay me anything. Well, that's a load of baloney, right? You're paying them something. And within investments, there's commissions to be paid sometimes. You know, they're called loads. That's the word, you know, another word that you want to pick up. You should never have to invest in any load mutual funds. But then there's a cost to doing the investment. And that's called, you know, an expense ratio, and that's what the mutual fund company charges you to just run the administration of the mutual fund. And so, again, everything has a cost that's out there. And David Swensen, you know, he was a chief investment officer at Yale. He says, when you look at the results on a after fee, after tax basis over reasonably long periods of time, there's almost no chance that you end up beating the index fund. And the reason he says that is because the index fund is a very, you know, low fee investment. There's not some high expensive fund manager that you have to pay to try and beat the market. And it's just pretty simple. And over the long term, you know, Casey said this a long time ago, you know, very, 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 very few people can beat the market long term. And so, you know, taking David Swensen's advice and just, you know, buying that inexpensive mutual fund might be the best way to go.
Yeah. And John Bogle has a great quote too. The miracle of compounding returns is overwhelmed by the tyranny of compounding cost. And as we kind of wrap up this episode, you know, continue to stay informed, you know, whether it's through this podcast or through other podcasts. And just remember that it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's a journey. Taking time to educate yourself as you're doing on this podcast. Keep peeling back those layers, you know. And before we wrap up, we want to give everybody at least one action item to take from this episode. How will you continue to educate yourself to know more about market history to aid you in harnessing your emotions, to help remaining focused on the long term and knowing what you want and why? And I know that was a mouthful, but it's really, you know, knowing more about your investments, the what you own, the history of them. And finally, for our disclaimer, this podcast for educational purposes only, as anything that you would find online. We only give advice to people we know their personal situation without knowing yours. It would be foolish to provide advice. For advice, consult the experts you may have in your life, your accountant, your attorney, your financial advisor, essentially the people who know you and your situation personally.